Coming up on Boston Public Radio, day after the Hobby Lobby decision, a local college asked out of a federal order banning discrimination against gays. There's much reaction, including from the mayor of Salem, who will join us. Then childhood obesity is allegedly on the decline, but still a big problem. A local doctor joins us who has a plan. Write prescriptions for exercise, then we'll ask you if it'll work. Then food writer Corby Kummer on the question of our times. Is competitive eating, like shoving 61 hot dogs in your pie hole on July 4th, a legitimate athletic endeavor?
Okay, Karen Miller from Innovation Hub on where we get our news now and where we'll get it tomorrow, and we'll ask you where you get yours. Then Boston College has taken huge heat for giving up confidential material that has endangered ex-IRA members in Ireland. Jack Dunn from Boston College defends his institution. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hi, Jim.
So, President Michael Lindsay of Gordon College, which, by the way, is in Wenham, Massachusetts, was among a handful of religious leaders who sent a letter to the White House this week asking to be exempted from a planned executive order that would ban discrimination against hiring people based on their sexual orientation. The group framed their request for an exemption as a matter of religious freedom. And by the way, speaking of that, the letter was sent a day after the so-called Hobby Lobby decision, which, as you know, is where the Supreme Court said that certain businesses did not need to provide contraceptive care because it conflicted with their religious beliefs. So far, the request has backfired in a number of ways, including in Salem, Massachusetts. Mayor Kim Driscoll has decided to end a contract the city had with Gordon College, which lets the school use their town hall. We're going to get your thoughts on this controversy in a minute, but first, the mayor joins us on the line. Mayor Driscoll, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, guys. How are things?
Good.
Very good, Mayor Driscoll. So what was the deal you guys had with Gordon College that you're dumping now?
So the arrangement we had with Gordon was a contract to manage a facility known as Old Town Hall. It serves as a place for people rent for functions. It's a backdrop in Derby Square. It's also home to Cry Innocent, a Gordon-affiliated production, and the Salem Museum, also Gordon-affiliated, but a museum and orientation center on Salem history.
And what's the formal reason, or the informal? What's the reason you terminated the arrangement, Kim Driscoll?
Yeah, so what happened is, as a result of the president's letter, President Gordon College's letter to the White House, it certainly caused concern locally within our community with respect to our contractual relationships with Gordon. The city in March adopted a fully LGBT-inclusive non-discrimination ordinance, and many folks are aware of that. And when they saw this issue with the president, it caused some concern. And there were lots of folks in our community who felt both hurt, offended, devalued. But the real issue for the termination is not the letter the president wrote to the White House, but more importantly, their standards of behavior. They have conduct behavioral standards at Gordon College that plainly discriminate against the LGBT community. And therefore, under our non-discrimination ordinance, we cannot contract with an entity that does that.
Mayor Driscoll, what are those behavioral standards?
There are several of these things. They apply to all students, staff, and faculty at Gordon College, both on campus and off campus, and it prohibits homosexual activity, alcohol drinking. I mean, there's a number of them, but the one obviously that was most of concern to us is this that prohibition.
And you didn't know about that before, Mayor Driscoll, prior to this letter going public?
Yeah, we didn't. I'm not sure we ever thought of Gordon as a community that wasn't inclusive. They are a Christian college, but they've a long had a relationship in Salem and on the North Shore, and frankly been thought of as more of a liberal Christian college. And I've never experienced the college or any of the productions, you know, acting in a discriminatory way. But clearly, I don't know if there's a change going on, but that particular standard, it flies completely in the face of the non-discrimination ordinance.
We're talking
They did some. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say who you were again for listeners, Mayor Kim Driscoll from Salem. You know, the Gordon College president, Michael Lindsay, is fairly new. I think he got there in 2011. Do you have any indication that this is sort of a new deal under a different president?
You know, I had a chance to talk with President Lindsay before we took this action to just make sure I was clear on, you know, what they were trying to do and, you know, better understood it. It was causing concern within our community. I wanted him to be aware of that. And I think his stance is that they're, you know, just behaving as if they always did. I think he indicated that he was, you know, this was not something that the institution fully agreed with, that there were students and others, faculty members that had signed a petition, you know, protesting
yes.
this particular stance, but that it was not something that they were looking to deter from, you know. And it, if you read those standards, those, you know, life and conduct behavioral standards, they just do not comport. And in Salem, with our history, you know, we know how the story ends. When you ostracize people, when you stigmatize and discriminate against any group, it's not anything that we could stand for.
You mean you know about it from hundreds of years ago, in addition to current events, is where you're going, correct, Kim Driscoll?
I mean, I think those values are really important to us, given what happened here in 1692.
Yes. No, Kim Driscoll, last thing from me. Adrian Walker made the piece in a column in the Boston Globe that while they signed on, the president signed on to a letter to the White House saying, please exempt us from this federal executive, or this executive order that's about to be promulgated, that the president went on to say, but we have no intention of discriminating against gays, which is a beyond preposterous argument I would make. But did he make the same case to you? Don't worry, even though we're doing it, we're not going to, even though we're signed on to the letter, we have no intention of doing what we're saying we have a right to do as a function of our religious freedom.
You know, I don't want to, it wasn't a very detailed conversation.
Okay.
I think his understanding is that there are members of the LGBT community on campus, and that if they remain celibate, somehow they're in compliance with their conduct of, you know, behavioral standards. As I said, it's, to us, it was just blatantly discriminatory. And we were planning on taking back management of this facility as of September 1st.
Right.
But this was causing such concern, such anger, and again, people really feeling devalued, that we felt like we had to terminate this relationship earlier. And it certainly did conflict with our non-discrimination ordinance. So,
well, one last thing, if I can, just based on what you said about, you know, there are gay and lesbian students on the campus. So did he say this to you, that there was sort of a don't ask, don't do kind of policy, meaning as long as people are quiet, or as you said, celibate about it, we're fine with it? Did he say that to you?
I don't want to put words in his mouth,
okay.
Jim. I think he should really speak for himself. I mean, we know members of the Gordon community, both staff, alumni, and students, and I think there are LGBT members who mm-hmm. attend school and are on campus, or were formerly, you know, members. So, you know, I think that exists. And look, I don't think being a Christian college means you have to discriminate against people. I mean, I love the story to end differently, with the Gordon community coming together and recognizing that it's a really quality institution, and it's being devalued by this conduct behavioral standard. And there is a way they continue the good work they do without discriminating against people. And I think that's the message, you know, for us, that's really important here.
Well, you sent it. Mayor Kim Driscoll of Salem, thanks so much for your time, Mayor. We appreciate it. And by the way, thank you, Kim. We should also make clear, the mayor said you should ask the president about that. We did request that the president of the college join us. He is apparently on vacation. They said they might provide a representative, and we're going to be discussing this for a bit. So if the representative would like to join us, we'd love to have him or her with us.
So that was Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll, as Jim just said. We're going to open up the lines now to you and ask you what you think about this at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What's the email, Jim?
I don't know. I'll look it up in a second. Okay. BPR at WGBH.org.
Thank you very much.
Balance there.
BPR at WGBH.org. If you have an opinion you'd like to send us via email. Is there a fine line between honoring religious beliefs and using religious orthodoxy to discriminate? And at what point do religious freedoms end and social views and discrimination begin? Our number again, 877-301-8970. If you're a student or an employee at Gordon, or if you're an alumnus, we'd love to hear from you as well, 877-301-8970. There was an alumnus who said that he was very, very upset because he is a gay guy, mm-hmm. and he felt that he not only felt uncomfortable at Gordon, he felt he's left his faith entirely, and partly because he felt the discrimination that started there. Probably didn't start there, probably started before that, but that he felt during his time at Gordon.
You know, one of the interesting things here, and I mentioned this in the introduction to when right before Kim Driscoll joined us, is while they contend, and I assume it's true, that they get 15 signatures, they were preparing this letter prior to the Hobby Lobby decision. It is not insignificant to say that it's the day after the Hobby Lobby decision. And by the way, while the if you read the majority, the opinion there, majority opinion there, well, it only applies narrowly to this situation. Well, a lot of us who were predicting, including our guest that day, constitutional law expert from Harvard, said the potential for this to be a slippery slope. Well, I think here is the slippery slope, that if it turns out that your religious, your perception of your religious freedom conflicts with a mandate, a government mandate, you shouldn't have to do it. And Adrian Walker, I think, makes the best point that anyone's made so far in his column in the Globe. If this is a principled decision by Gordon College, and I have to assume it is on the part of the president of Gordon College, then you have an easy out. You don't need an exemption from the federal executive order. Don't take any federal money, and then you don't have to comply with it. It's that simple.
And we should also point out that this letter was signed not just by the Gordon College president, but also by the chief executive of Catholic Charities USA, the executive editor of Christianity Today, prominent evangelical pastor Rick Warren. He's the one that
He's the megachurch guy. Yeah.
Between McCain and Barack Obama the first time around, and many of the Christian leaders, and they talked about, and I think it's somewhat of an exaggeration, that without a robust religious exemption, this is according to the Globe piece, this expansion of hiring rights will come at an unreasonable cost to the common good, national unity.
Well, by the way, you know, some people may believe this, and some people believe it's a natural extension of the law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States by a majority decision. But for those who were saying afterwards, what are you even worrying about? Maybe this is going to happen in some far reaches of the South. This is not going to come to liberal states like Massachusetts. Well, it has. It's happening in Wenham, Massachusetts at Gordon College. And I thought Kim Driscoll described it beautifully. Even though she knew it was a religious institution, she assumed it was a liberal-leaning religious institution that was a very tolerant one. And maybe it has been. I know nothing about the school other than this.
Here, when Catholic Charities several years ago said they could not sanction adoptions to gay couples,
they stopped doing it.
There were board members very prominent board members who resigned over that, and consequently, Catholic Charities, which had done so well in the adoption business, got out of it. I mean, it was really sad.
877-301-8970. So I guess we're asking you to decide the Hobby Lobby decision part two. For Massachusetts, for Gordon College in Wenham, who's right here? Is Mayor Driscoll right and some of the students and alum who are protesting, or is Gordon College on the correct path?
Let's start with Jessica from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, Jessica.
Hi, how are you? I listen to you guys every day.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to say that I went to Gordon, and we have a lot of friends that went to Gordon, so I've been watching them comment about this on social media, and just being very frustrated with my friends who I thought were intelligent and accepting, just writing very mean things about President Lindsay. And while I may or may not agree with his decision, at least he took a stand, you know, for our school and for what he believed, and stood by that and stood by Hobby Lobby. I think that I would like for my future children someday to grow up in America where they have the freedom to stand by things that they believe. And I agree with Jim about don't take federal money then if you're gonna, you know, have certain beliefs. But I believe that private organizations like Hobby Lobby or private very expensive colleges should be able to state their opinions about such things.
And by the way, we should make clear, I think regardless of one's political persuasion, people would agree that if you don't take the federal money, then you don't have to comply. There's no dispute. You don't have to comply with the federal executive order. Jessica, were you there when President Lindsay was there or before him?
No, I left. I was before him.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm curious, Jessica, did you know gay kids at the school when you were there? Were there gay kids?
I did, and it was a very underground community, and I can't speak to if they felt it was tolerant or if they felt accepted, because I was not a gay or lesbian, bisexual on Gordon's campus, so I don't know what it felt like to be them. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you if the reason it was an underground community, I assume, is that they were afraid if they came out.
Well, she said she wasn't sure. She doesn't know
that they'd be expelled. Well, I'm just wondering what your sense of why it was an underground community.
Well, the mayor commented on our life and conduct statement that you sign when you go into the college. So in the same way that it's a dry campus, and you're not allowed, even if you're 21, to be drinking on campus. I was an RA. You're not allowed to be drinking, and we enforce those rules. Like these kinds of things are in our life and conduct statements. So all of our friends who signed those statements and like loved their time at Gordon for those very reasons, that it was a faith integrated classroom. I think it's kind of two-faced to say like you're going to support the dry campus thing, but you're not going to support the other thing. And I don't think that that means that like you shouldn't be accepting or loving of like people who are in that community. But I just think that they signed those statements and they knew what they were getting into when they went to that college. And it was in our life and conduct statement.
Jessica, I have to say you're a good spokesperson for your point of view. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. And I thought Jessica said it well. She doesn't want to see the president criticized. She thinks he took a principled stand and says the extension of that principled stand is to say, I'm not going to take federal money anymore. It's an easy solution. There's no public controversy. They're free to do, well, there may be some public controversy. They're free to do what they do. And again, as it says, again, from Adrian Walker's column, Lindsay, the president, posted a statement on the school's website apparently intended to show that no, Gordon College wasn't openly embracing discrimination. We want the right to discriminate, but we have no plan to do that.
But listen to what this letter says. This is what got me going. I'm quoting from it directly. We believe that all persons, this is a letter, of course, that the president of Gordon College signed and these other Christian groups signed. We believe that all persons are created in the divine image of the Creator and are worthy of respect and love without exception, end quote. So they're worthy of respect and love, but they're not worthy of a job. That's the part that I have difficulty.
But he's contending. I agree with you completely, but he's contending we would not discriminate against somebody in employment, which leads to sort of a circular argument. Then why do you need the exemption if you have no intention of using the exemption? And I guess he would argue, and again, he or his spokesperson is welcome to join us, that it's an issue of religious freedom. Robert, you're in Fall River. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Robert.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, first of all, there seems to be a lot of religious groups, political and otherwise, that are spending a lot of time, effort, and money every single year on discrimination and, to this point, the ability to discriminate, the right to discriminate in the future, even though they have no idea what potential scenarios might come up. Realistically, in this vein, that these schools, these political or religious groups are in, the Bible doesn't talk about, you know, you must discriminate against this, you must make sure these people don't do that, you must make sure this doesn't happen. The Bible says, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless. Why are not they not focusing on these things, which are very positive, proactive things for the community, which is actually why churches and religious organizations get free tax-free exemptions, because they are supposedly provide worthwhile opportunities for the communities that they're in.
You know, Robert, one of the reasons why I think that Pope Francis has been celebrated around the world by Catholics and non-Catholics alike is because he spent so much of his, how long has he been there, 16 months or something? So much of his first year and a half focusing on exactly what you talked about, the poor and those sorts of issues.
Right, and exactly that. And have you noticed how much backlash he's been getting for focusing on that? And it's just crazy. I don't understand why people are being allowed to, they're fighting for the right to discriminate when we should be talking about bigger issues like the fact that healthcare reform is really what the churches are so upset about. If healthcare empirically said we're going to take care of the health of all of our females, just because they're women, they are not second-class citizens. They shouldn't have their health concerns, which birth control does affect a lot of health concerns for a lot of females. Rather than say, well, we're not going to pay for it because we don't necessarily need to, and women don't need birth control.
Robert, do you remember, what's the name of the woman who is the nuns on the bus, the sister who was with us a couple of months
Simone,
ago?
Oh, God, I can't
Simone
remember.
Campbell.
Simone Campbell was with us, and Marjorie mentioned the great battle where the bishops were leading the charge against the Affordable Care Act, And the nuns were leading the charge in support of the Affordable Care Act. Hey, Robert, another great call. Thank you very much for joining us.
From my hometown.
No, from Full Reeve.
I'm so impressed.
What do you say, Full Reeve?
Full
Reeve, yeah.
Dan from Worcester, what do you think about Gordon College?
Morning, Dan. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi, my dear Jim.
Hi. Hey.
The whole thing is just, to me, is causes a lot of controversy over it's like people who are the colleges says it's being discriminated against in some manner. The mayor of that town says that the gays are being discriminated in some manner. It seems to me like it's people with points of view different, but their points of view. And I don't think it's either side is trying to be malicious about anything. It's just people trying to live whatever it is, whether it be their faith or their convictions are. And why can't we do that without being brandished or branded as trying to be discriminatory against someone or a racist situation? It's just people trying to live their lives in the way that they believe that their lives should be lived.
You know, Dan, I have to say, the concept of people lowering the temperature of these discussions is one that I hope we'd all find very appealing. But isn't the way for that to be achieved in this situation, Kim Driscoll, the mayor, did what she thought was the right thing. President Lindsey did what he thought was the right thing. But wouldn't this all have been muted if he said, we just won't take federal dollars anymore because we don't like the strings. We believe the strings that are attached to those federal dollars cause us to violate our religious convictions. Then we probably wouldn't even be reading about this in the paper, no?
Yes, I agree with you 200% there, Jim. When you take money from someone, whether it be the federal government or you borrow money from your friend, you become a slave to that person that you just borrowed the money from.
Boy, do you ever.
Yeah. Hey. So I agree with you 200% here. So a lesson to everybody, don't take federal money, don't borrow money, and go on and live your life as you please.
Can I tell you something, Dan? Dan, I have owed Marjorie $20 for months, and it's exactly like you described. It's been living hell.
It's
Dan, thanks for a great call,
me,
as always.
However.
We appreciate it.
Well, of course, they also get tax exemptions, too. It's a big controversial thing in Boston because between the schools and the churches, there are so many tax exempt
Do you know that
people.
More than 50% of the property in Boston is tax exempt?
And
universities,
they have those
hospitals, schools.
In lieu of taxes, but they're tiny percentages.
Some
of
aren't, but
paying.
The vast majority are. But the consequence of that, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but since you brought it up, you know what the consequence of that tax
What's
exemption is? That people who pay property taxes, landowners, small businesses, et cetera, have to pay much more because obviously they have to fill the hole that is left by the nonprofits who, including some universities, who are nonprofits selling audio equipment for $8,000 in the school bookstore. In any case, our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about the decision by the president of Gordon College, which is in Wenham, Massachusetts, to sign a letter, I think with 14 other religious leaders, asking the president for an exemption from his executive order, which, you know, banned discrimination against based on sexual orientation and hiring. I have to say, I'm embarrassed by this. Did you know that there was no ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation in the federal level?
I
was not aware.
I did not.
But essentially, they've done it. He has a contract that was going to expire anyway in September. A contract with Salem has been terminated by the mayor. She joined us a couple of minutes ago. And we're basically asking you which side you are on here. And we did invite the president of Gordon to join us. He's on vacation, and his spokesperson said they might be available, but apparently they are not.
Richard from Cambridge, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Richard?
Hi, Richard.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I always thought religion was a personal thing and a private thing. And, you know, religion means something to me. My parents were Holocaust survivors. But what does that have to do with any of this stuff? You know, religion, none of these things that they're talking about are actually consistent with their religious teachings. Jesus couldn't survive in this world, being a dark-skinned Aramaic, speaking person, telling the moneylenders to get lost. And, you know, so what is this really about? And I think it starts with the libertarians, and I think they've been pushing the envelope for years and years, eating away at little things here and there, and eventually they just chip away and chip away. and so forth, and we're making accommodations for groups that we shouldn't be making accommodations for. This country revels in the idea of separation of church and state, and it also revels in the idea of protecting religion. But where is it that religion needs to be foisted upon people?
You know, Richard, again, on a tangent, you made me think of something Marjorie and I have discussed much often on the air. We both, I think I'm speaking for you, Marjorie, share your view, particularly among political candidates. If you're a person of great faith, then for the most part, keep it to yourself. Don't wear it on your sleeve. Who is the president in recent times who probably was the most devoutly religious? The same president who kept it most to himself.
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I used to get a kick out of Bill Clinton. You know, he'd be caught in the midst of this big scandal with some other woman. You see him on Sunday morning coming out of church with this big, huge Bible. You know, not that you can't be, doing these missteps and be in church, but it used to crack me up.
Well, also, we saw Barack Obama much more commonly at church after the whole thing with Reverend Wright. Remember, after that, he had to show that he went to a Christian church. He was not a Muslim. Significant percentage of the American population seemed to believe.
Well, first he was in the front row of Reverend Wright's church hearing all this racist discussion, and then he became a Muslim overnight. It was weird. Did. Reverend Wright was not a Muslim.
That's a very fine point.
Anyway, let's go to Gabriella in Haverhill. Hi, Gabriella.
Hello there.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
Great.
I love your show.
Thank you.
You know, Marjorie, I do think there is a distinction in saying that someone's created in the image of God and then having the right not to hire that person. Simply because, and now I am not saying in any way that, for example, being an alcoholic and being a homosexual are the same thing. I'm not saying that. But theoretically, if you're looking for a babysitter, you're not going to choose someone who's an alcoholic. And it has nothing to do with the person that they are, whether or not they were created in the image of God. It has nothing to do with that. You just choose that because of that person's lifestyle choices. You don't want them to babysit your kids. And you should have a right to say that, shouldn't you?
Well, I don't think that's a very good analogy, Gabriella, because you're talking about a person who's got a drinking problem versus a whole class of people that I would say are not making lifestyle choices. They're born with a sexual orientation, and you're saying none of those people are worthy of jobs. So I don't think that's really a fair comparison.
Now, well, let's say you have a church and you're looking for a youth minister. And of course, if you're a Catholic church, you don't want the kids who come to your youth ministry to be taught that the homosexual lifestyle is in accordance with Catholic teaching.
Gabriella, can I stop you for a second? Homosexual lifestyle is I don't mean to be the pain in the you know what. It's not a lifestyle. It is even the present. It's an orientation. But go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Sure, but. Shouldn't you, if you are a church, shouldn't you have the right to choose someone who, or to choose not to deny someone a job because their orientation doesn't go along with whatever it is that you're trying to teach?
Yeah. Well, there are an awful lot of gay priests in the Catholic Church, Gabrielle, which is one of the difficulties of the Catholic Church's stand on the so-called homosexual lifestyle, a term I hate as well. But again, and there's also a great deal of variation. There are a lot of churches who have gay and lesbian groups, who have gay Catholic churches, I mean parishes, who have gay and lesbian parents groups and so forth and so on. So the bottom line is, it's 2014. We have legalized marriage in Massachusetts between homosexuals. We have legalized it all across the country. We have moved on from where people don't forget, people used to discriminate and say, oh, I can't hire you because you're a black person married to a white person, or a white person married to a black person, or those kinds of things. So I think, the train's left the station, Gabriella. You know what I mean?
But Gabriella, thank you. We appreciate it. Very quickly, Maureen, you're in Rhode Island. You'll end this. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
My comment really relates to this whole concept of slippery slope. I've been fuming since the Hobby Lobby decision, as have many, many women.
Yeah, me too.
I'm in healthcare. I am a nurse midwife. I write prescriptions for birth control. The struggle for women to get their birth control is beyond compare. But I wanted to speak to the slippery slope and some of the hypocrisy that I'm seeing, because I've learned that in the days since Hobby Lobby decision, that Hobby Lobby has invested some of their retirement funds in the same big pharmaceutical companies that produce birth control. And how this wasn't discovered by the Supreme Court in their investigation is beyond me, because that is hypocrisy.
Let me just say, Maureen, because some people will say, well, how does she know that? One of our colleagues, Amanda, says that Mother Jones has reported that they do invest. Their mutual funds in Hobby Lobby Retirement include Teva, which makes Plan B, and Actavis, which makes generic Plan B. And one of those companies does IUD. So you are absolutely right. Go ahead.
And so, you know, how that wasn't discovered by a clerk working for the Supreme Court justices is beyond me, because that would have colored their decision.
Maureen?
If you want to claim, and you know, the same thing, like, is this Gordon College case is on a different level. It's not related to birth control, but we are going to see a whole host of institutions stepping forward and discriminating. And this is a war on women. Do not be mistaken. It is a war on women.
Maureen, thanks for the call. I want to say for a third and final time, since so people appreciate that we're trying to be as fair as possible here, we did invite the president and a representative from Gordon College, and though they couldn't make it today, if they want to come tomorrow or next week, we are more than happy to entertain that.
Okay, up next, what are doctors doing to fight the call of the great indoors? They're prescribing outdoor exercise for kids who would otherwise be inside and inactive and in front of their TVs and at their computers. Our conversation about that is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey, political junkies. The Scrum is now a podcast. Our pop-up tussle on politics with reporter Adam Riley, analyst David Bernstein, and me, Peter Katzis. Subscribe today or listen online at WGBHnews.org.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, right hand on blue, left foot on yellow. The WGBH Curiosity Desk says happy birthday to Twister. Tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Brigham and Women's Hospital, committed to providing innovative joint replacement options that can help improve the quality of life for hundreds of people each year. More at brighamandwomens.org. And Northeastern University, where researchers are creating interactive tools from apps to avatars to help us make healthier choices. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And finally, there is some good news about prescriptions. Now on the market, doctors are prescribing a remedy that's cheap, can't be sold on the black market, and if it becomes addictive, it actually might be a good thing. That's a prescription to go outdoors and be active. The Appalachian Mountain Club and MGH are joining forces, Mass General Hospital, are joining forces to get kids and their parents outside. The program is called Outdoors RX. We're going to get your thoughts on this in a minute, but first, joining us on the line is Dr. Christina Sirica, a pediatric pulmonologist at MGH and Outdoor RX's medical director. Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure being here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you for being here. So, Doctor, tell us, what exactly are you doing over there?
Well, basically, the Outdoors RX program was based on the principle that getting kids active outdoors is good for their health, it's good for their overall well-being, and it's ultimately good for the environment if they learn to appreciate and protect it. And so the overarching mission of the program is very, very simple. It's simply to help kids and families be active outdoors and show them that it's fun and easy.
And when you say fun and easy, part of the reason I think it's uneasy is because many people, and by the way, I'm totally with you on this. Let me make that clear as a fairly round child myself not too long ago, is everybody thinks it's got to be an organized activity. You got to have a league. You got to have a baseball field. You have to have something. You're talking about some of the most mundane kinds of activities included, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do with this program is really help families explore the outdoors, you know, albeit with our guidance, with the guidance of the Appalachian Mountain Club, but really learn to be more comfortable outdoors, to be able to do unstructured activities. And that makes them more active. It gets them engaged in it and gets them excited about it. And you're absolutely right that kids are doing more structured program. So this is a nice, refreshing change from that.
You know, Dr. Sirica, one of the things I noticed, you know, my kids are older now, but when they were little, I don't know when it changed, but certainly it used to be in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you could kind of send the kids out after school, tell them to come home when the street lights came on, and you were a good parent if you did that. Somewhere along the line, or certainly today, you're not a good parent if you do that anymore, because just you're viewed as not watching your kids closely to let them out. And this is not just in dangerous neighborhoods in the inner city where you're talking about, you know, some kind of gunplay. This is in the suburbs. That's one of the problems. Nobody lets their kids out unsupervised because you're going to be a bad parent if you do.
You know, you are absolutely right. That I mean, we're all much more protective in many ways of our children now than we were before. You know, lots of factors, I suspect, have, you know, factored into that. But you're absolutely right. The perception is that, you know, you need to know where your children are. You need to be supervising their activities. You know, gone are the days of just sending your kid outdoors to play on their own for hours on end, and they come home at some point, you know, in time for dinner or not. You know, whether we'll be able to change that sort of perception, or whether it's right to change that perception, I don't know. But the bottom line is that we do need to be getting kids more active, you know, outdoors, doing more things other than just plugging into their many and, you know, ubiquitous devices. So this isn't, you know, this is by no means a perfect solution and, you know, a panacea, but it's one step in the direction towards getting kids up off the couch, unplugged, and outside playing.
So, Doctor, we're talking, by the way, with Dr. Christina Sirica. She's from MGH, talking about the outdoors, outdoor RXs, and she's the medical director of that. So do you actually give little prescriptions, like if you're going to give somebody an amoxicillin prescription, a little paper to tell them to do this? Is it a physical thing?
Yeah, we absolutely do. It is a physical thing.
What does it say?
You know, what was that?
What does it say?
So it looks like a real old-fashioned regular prescription. I say old-fashioned because most of our prescriptions now are done online electronically. But it looks like what we think of when we think of a prescription with the RX symbol and everything. And on it, it simply says, you know, get up, get out, and get active. And it includes a link to the Outdoors RX website. And what that offers families is much more than just the recommendation to go outside and be active, but it hooks them up with free Appalachian Mountain Club-led programs for families in their community. So we're running this in two pilot communities of Framingham and Waltham. And so when they log on to the website, they see a whole list of different activities that are going on in their area, in their neighborhoods, different times of day, different days of the week for different, you know, ages of kids. And so it offers them that. The other thing they can find on the website when they go to that link is it also offers an incentive program. So it has, you know, a point system where kids can actually, you know, log in the number of minutes they've spent outdoors and actually claim those minutes and redeem them as points towards free stuff. And so the free stuff is stuff that we hope will get them outdoors. So it's water bottles. It's T-shirts, things like that.
Is it working, doctor? Is there any evidence that it's actually working? I mean, I love the idea, but is it working?
So we are basically at our one-year anniversary. So we launched this last summer, so we're basically 1 year out. And I think we've all just been, I think, astounded by how well it's working. We have trained at least, I believe, the number of 75 pediatricians in the Framingham and Waltham areas. So we also have included the outlying areas around those towns, because we're not trying to limit anybody. We want everybody, you know, anybody's welcome to this program. But we've trained about, I think, 75 pediatricians in this program, and the reception from them has been incredibly positive, because this gives them something tangible, quick, practical that they can offer families as one, you know, it's a very practical thing to be able to do, because they all want kids to get outdoors and active. This gives them a way of doing that. We have had, I believe the number now is over 2,500 kids participate in the program in terms of the actual, you know, on-the-ground activities in the communities. And likewise, the reception has been just, you know, kids' eyes are open, and families are incredibly appreciative of the opportunity to, you know, have somebody kind of, you know, metaphorically hold their hand in the process of kind of trying out being outdoors and active.
Well, as you said, their eyes are open. I hope their eyes are open and their mouths are occasionally closed. Last thing from me, Dr. Sirica, if I can, is Marjorie and I have talked about this a lot in the 15 years we've been on the radio. When there was a report about, I don't know, 2 months ago, that there had been a 43% decline in childhood obesity over the past decade. I think it was for 2 to 5 year olds or something like that.
Yes.
I have to say, I found that really hard to believe. You actually are in the field. Did you buy it?
You know, that number is, no, I don't.
Good.
You know, I think it's the, we're always, I think it always serves us well to look at the data that we have very carefully and see how we can explain the information. And it may be a real change, but it may also be, you know, reflective of some other factor. You know, one of the findings from that study was also that, you know, obesity is still a very real problem in kids. And it also seems to be unevenly distributed in our population. So it really is disproportionately affecting underserved populations, lower income populations, yeah. minority populations. Yeah. And that's, to me, very, very worrisome. And it's part of the reason that for this program, we actually chose two communities that have, you know, very diverse populations, but include a large underserved minority, you know, populations that also have a relatively high rate of childhood obesity.
Doctor, thanks. That was great.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Dr. Sirica. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Christina Sirica is a pediatric pulmonologist at MGH and Outdoor Rx's medical director. So we're going to ask you guys at 877-301-8970. We're getting a prescription from the doctor to ride a bike or to spend more time outdoors. Would this work for you? Could it motivate you, motivate your little kids to get away from the computer, get away from the TV, and go outside for a while? It's just the kind of drug that you need. Also,
well, by the way, do you hear what she said? It's not just a prescription. It's a prescription with link to what we were discussing yesterday about banks. Free stuff that comes along with this. And my sense is that it is the right prescription.
But there is something bizarre that has kind of come to this. We have to have doctors give us incentives to do something as, you know, normal.
No, it's not. No, you know why it's not? It's not because of everything that parents and these kids have to fight against. The advertising of all these horrible foods, all the horrible fast food stuff that is everywhere you turn, all that sort of thing. I love this idea. I'm not suggesting it's the cure-all, but we want to know what you think. Would a prescription work for your kid, for your family, or would you just say it's another gimmick? 877-301-8970. And if you don't think it's part of the cure, tell us what is. What's the fix? Because I'm with this doctor. I don't buy this 43. I generally believe these kinds of surveys. 43% reduction over 10 years. Look at the kids around you. Look at the communities around you. I mean, it's just, it is a horrible epidemic, childhood obesity. And I think this is part of the fix. And let me just say one more thing, by the way, because it's something I've actually fixated on a lot. For those who say it's just a health issue, which is bad enough, being a kid who's overweight has an impact in multitudes of ways, psychologically, obviously.
No.
Two, a kid who is overweight, the science shows the kids don't do as well at school. Are unable to pay attention as well as other kids who are not overweight. So the implications of this are another, Marjorie, make fun of this too, immense. I mean, they really are immense. And something, it's great what the president's wife is doing. This Let's Move program is a wonderful part of the action, even though she's being fought by House Republicans and some in the food industry about school lunches and that sort of thing. Everything that can be done has got to be done.
So let me be clear before we take the calls.
Okay.
You're thinking, you know, it's not what most people do to come in to work every day with four or five or six little Tupperware containers full of Brussels sprouts. You don't think everybody does that?
Can I tell you something? I probably weigh less now than I did when I was 11. I mean, that's how bad it is. 877, okay. Not quite, but close. 877-301-8970. This story was in the Globe, by the way. And, you know, one other thing, if our colleagues, if there's a website, which we should have asked Dr. Sirica about to connect people to this Outdoors RX program, it'd be great if we could give it to people before we leave. 877-301-8970. John, you're in Scituate. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, John.
Hey there. So I'm a little bit concerned about using these extrinsic motivators to be able to get children to go outside rather than building upon their own intrinsic motivation, doing it for the sake of doing it, and being involved in the world that's around them. Because you're going to have to continually get these children to have better and better incentives to be able to continue to get them to go outside, right? Because you get a t-shirt once, great. You get a water bottle once, great. So what happens when I want something better? It causes this kind of very artificial and vapid reason to be able to enjoy the world that's around you instead of getting them part of the, you know, the Charles River Trail Park.
Yeah, but John, can I tell you why I disagree with you from personal experience? I think the thing that causes to be the recurring incentive that you're legitimately concerned about is you actually see results. One, you see you see physical results in yourself, which I think makes you feel better about yourself, and you do begin to experience something beyond the screen on your iPad, and hopefully that's going to inspire you too. So my point is, it's an ongoing motivator. Does that make any sense to you or no?
I would have to see the longitudinal results of this kind of
You're probably right. You may be right.
It doesn't make any sense.
I got it, John. Thank you. I mean, you have a legitimate concern. I just think that anything that – I think this is where Dr. Sirica was going. Anything that gets the kid away from the screen and from the couch and out in the world is at least a good first step, and hopefully it becomes addictive.
The problem is the attitude about what makes a good parent in 2014. I mean, the problem with these things, and I hope that they work, is that they've always going to be organized by grown-ups, you know, and there's always going to be grown-ups
supervising.
No, you
made a good point. Yeah, I know.
So there's no more close the door, get out and play, and come back. And because, you know, you think about this all the time. If something happened to one of my kids, everybody would say, oh, well, where were you?
I know, you're absolutely
where
right.
Where were you? We're supposed to sit with them at the playground. Even when they're like 9 and 10 at the playgrounds across the street. So this whole idea of having to watch these kids 24/7 prevents kids from being able to go out and spend hours looking at bugs and picking up rocks.
But can I tell you, work a compromise. The compromise I worked out when I was in high school, I went to Central High School in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. is, Mom, you can take the subway to school with me. You can't come to class. That's not a good compromise.
Well,
by the way, the website, before we go ahead, because I mentioned it and one of our colleagues got it, outdoorsrx.org, and you can connect to the program that Dr. Sirica was talking about. I'm sorry.
Didn't you live in some high-rise?
I lived in a high-rise,
so you would have had to go all the way down to the first floor to go out and look at the bugs.
That is true. No, I looked at them from the 19th floor. I lived in apartment 1901, and I'd look.
19th floor?
19th floor, top floor.
Okay, well, that
And what I've told you, what's famous about the apartment I lived in?
That the statue of Rocky is right out in front of it.
No,
that
would be wrong.
Oh, what?
When Rocky Balboa, otherwise known as Sylvester Stallone, got to the top of the art museum steps and turned around and raised his fists in the right-hand corner, upper corner of the screen, you could see my apartment. What do you think of that?
Oh, my God.
That's pretty exciting.
Doesn't get much better than that.
No, it surely does. Debbie, and of course, I was in my apartment having a cheeseburger at the time while Rocky was running up the steps. Debbie, you're in Braintree. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there, Debbie.
Hello, how are you all?
Excellent, thank you.
The point that I want to make is I have a son in elementary school, and it's pretty sad that they have barely any recess time. They barely have any gym classes. They can't play tag on the recess floor anymore. They can't play kickball. They can't play dodgeball. They can't do anything. They sit there. They end up talking. They bounce the ball around. They pass it to each other. They have no physical stimulation. And 9 out of 10 kids that I know, little boys my son's age, are on Adderall. ADHD medication.
Debbie, you are singing my tune. You are so right. It my kids' school at one point, they wouldn't let them go outside on the snow in the wintertime. You know why? Because they were afraid somebody's going to throw snowballs and someone's going to slip on the ice. So they stayed inside.
Exactly. It all comes down to liabilities.
Yeah.
No one wants to take the step and say, listen, these are kids. You're going to have skin knees. God forbid you break an arm or something like that. But life happens. Let them have fun. Let them be kids. We can't even sell baked goods at the schools anymore
because
of obesity.
I know. I'm not going to tell you what side I'm on that. Debbie, thank
you
for the call.
Sell apples.
No, I know. But it is a problem when
oranges.
You have 400 cupcakes for the kids.
Well, Michael emailed before and he talked about the food desert issue, and that is really true in poor neighborhoods where there's not, you know, good places to get food. But even in the supermarkets, as we know now, a lot of the food in the supermarkets is full of sugar and
full of
preservatives and additives and stuff like that. So
you know, here's a Facebook posting from Ryan. He said, this is so perfect too. My mom and her friends complain about this all the time, as if when we were kids, we were hiking the Appalachian Trail or biking across America instead of sitting in front of the TV. Outdoor play is absolutely important, but I feel like boomers and the generation after it exaggerate the negative impact of technology on childhood and, quote, misremember, end quote, the way they raise their own kids. It's totally true. I mean, it is totally true. Our iPad was the television screen, and we weren't. The one difference, though, and I know this has been sounded by a lot of other people, so it's not an original thought. You want a tangible manifestation of the difference is 20 years ago, if you drove by a baseball field in any community, it was packed. I don't mean necessarily with an organized game. Drive by a baseball field now, you almost never see anything other than a mother and a father throwing a ball back and forth with their kid. I mean, it really is it's not a scientific thing, but you can see the difference. Bill, you're in Dorchester. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Bill.
Hi. The power of persistence is described by doctors is something that, you know, should be used for behavioral changes. Out in Dorchester, the
Cobham Square Health Center and the Health Works for Women group created a fitness center where doctors can write prescriptions for free memberships
for children and women to be able to participate in fitness.
That's great.
Another thing that interests us that the farmers market in Codman Square.
Hey, Bill, is this the Bill from Codman Square?
Yeah.
Bill Walczak, how are you? It's great to talk to you, Bill. Thank you for the call.
I heard this from Bill Walczak during the campaign.
But go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry. Continue.
That's okay. Well, thank you. In any case, yeah, the other thing that docs could do at Codman Square Health Center is they write prescriptions for fresh fruits and vegetables out of the farmer's market. And because of something called group visits, the doctors will bring their patients, groups of 10 patients, over to the farmer's market and help them choose vegetables and tell them how they should cook them and bring them back to the teaching kitchen to be able to do it. I mean, these are, you know, unfortunately, in the past world, you know, a few generations ago, people learned how to cook, people learned how to grow vegetables, people learned, you know, didn't have to be prompted to do exercising. But in the modern world, it just doesn't happen that way. So the ability of doctors to do more than just say, hey, you need to exercise more and you need to eat better, needs to be enhanced, especially in neighborhoods where there isn't that kind of access.
Well, Bill Walczak, you know better than I do that one of the problems in certain parts of Dorchester is parents are afraid to let their kids outside because they're worried about violence.
Well, which is why they built a gym. We built a gym, the HealthWorks group. Basically, the deal was I raised $650,000, and HealthWorks agreed to staff it for free. So
wow.
You know, we were able to build a gym at 450 Washington Street that's on a sliding fee scale for anybody based on income, but for doctors, they can write prescriptions for free memberships.
That's great.
So overall, there are possibilities, and you can get generous organizations like HealthWorks for Women, which actually taxes their own constituents. You know, people that join there's like a 1% fee that winds up going to a foundation that supports these efforts, and now they're looking to build another one. So it's you know, you can do these things. It takes a little bit of imagination, but it's really important because of the fact that, yes, they're violent, but we need to be able to provide the kinds of services that people in the suburbs just take for granted.
Bill, it's great to hear from you. I hope we'll hear from you again soon. Actually, we should have you in here. Bill Walczak, obviously, from Dorchester. Thank you for the call, and most recently a candidate for mayor.
Yep. Thank you very much, Bill. Up next, it is time. Is it time to retire the word foodie? I don't like that word myself.
I don't like it either.
Are you a foodie, Jim?
I am a food consumer.
Okay. Food writer Corby Cummer joins us to talk about gastronomic nomenclature as well as competitive eating and more. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
We'd like to say thanks to Ashley Holt,
David Bastian,
Judith Ellenwood.
Thanks to Julia Jennings,
Peter Simhauser,
Elizabeth McKee,
Arthur Cabral.
Thanks so much, James Wells.
To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you. And Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse, proud to sponsor the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend. Blue Man Group, presenting their first Boston Drum Off. More information available at blueman.com/Boston Drum Off. And Pure Solutions, featuring Pure's organic tick and mosquito treatments. You can eliminate black-legged deer ticks that can transmit Lyme disease with Pure's organic tick programs. More information at puresolutions.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie and Joey Jaws Christian Chestnut, 6 feet tall, weighs 225 pounds. And as you probably know, on July 4th at the 2014 Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, he ate 61 dogs in 10 minutes. Here's the point of the contest where he overtook his rival, Matt Stoney. Listen.
So they're running head and head for the lead. Now Chestnut goes just ahead. So they are very close at this point.
Two meats, one bun.
20 and 20.
There you see it. Now Joey's getting into his rhythm. Two meats, one bun, and then he catches up on the buns a little later. The buns obviously pose a challenge in this contest. The buns are weighty. They're like the hills of the Pyrenees for a Tour de France rider.
They're like the hills of the Pyrenees for a Tour de France rider. If you think of Joey Chestnut as an athlete, this latest win means that for the first time in a century, an athletic competitor leads his league for 8 years in a row. But is it fair to dignify competitive eating by calling it an athletic event? Joining us for his take on this and other food-related matters, from new restaurants to overused nomenclature, is Corby Cummer. Corby, as you know, is a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Hello there, Corby.
Hi there.
Well, Corby Cummer, there's this paragraph in one of these stories we read, I think from The Atlantic, where you also work, saying it might seem reasonable to call competitive eating a legitimate sport because there's a big audience base, highly organized league structure, and a meticulous training regimen. It adds some ability. Having been to a couple of these myself, and I found them disgusting, I wouldn't say that they were a real sport, but maybe I'm wrong. What do you think?
No, you're right. It's something that everybody feels that they can do. You don't have to be able to do a bunch of chin-ups or run around a track 8 times really fast. You can just be a glutton. Everybody feels they've got a shot at this. But
they're wrong, Corby. I'm serious. What's his name? Kobayashi, the guy who wouldn't sign the deal with Major League Eating, so he's now barred,
right?
Is this incredibly fit guy, the woman who was the Black Widow?
I saw her in East Boston. She weighs like 80 pounds. It's
they apparently work out like crazy. You know, when I first heard about competitive eating, I thought it was going to be these huge, fat guys.
Sumo wrestlers.
Which originally it was. But these are, I mean, I'm not saying they're athletes. You may be right about that. But they are surely fit human beings for the most part. No?
Mm-hmm.
And train? No?
Yeah, a lot of them. A lot of them in that defies your expectations of what you're doing. But why would you ever want to do this to your body, and why would you consider that something to be proud of? This is something I don't quite get.
Well, let me tell you something.
And when you go, I went to one gym.
Where'd you go?
Why did you go?
I was assigned to go cover it by the Boston Herald. I went to East Boston.
Oh, the sausage eating contest.
It was about 95 degrees, nice. 100% humidity. They're on the stage in the heat eating all these sausages. That crazy legs Conti guy was over there. And it is really pretty gross.
But people really like watching it. So this is the second piece The Atlantic has run about it. We did one in the print issue based on a book. And this by Gabriel Muller was on the web last month. And a really good and complete piece, because people become obsessed with this and they think of it as a sport. They're competitive regimens. They train. Sumo wrestlers, a big part of what they do is eat, and they train themselves to eat. So maybe there's something secretly appealing to people.
Okay. Now, you obviously, I assume, because you're a pretty terrific writer, I should say. I've read a lot of your stuff since I met you, Corby Cummer. How many times have you written pieces on Eric Booker, for example?
Oh, I would say at least zero.
Okay, at least zero. Now, Eric Booker, do you know who Eric Booker is?
No.
Please. Now, Eric Booker, of course, is the man who in 2002 ate 49 glazed donuts in 8 minutes. Let me repeat that because I got it wrong. 49 glazed donuts in 8 minutes. And by the way, that is the world record. I don't see you eating 49 glazed donuts in 8 minutes, Corby Cummer.
The minute you say that, I think, I bet I could do better than that. So maybe this is what everybody thinks. I wouldn't want to.
How much mayonnaise could you eat in 8 minutes? I'll tell you what the world record. I have a few world records here. How much mayonnaise do you think you could eat in 8 minutes?
You know, it depends on how much you swallow. I would be completely,
How many ounces? Tell me how many ounces you think you could max out.
In how many minutes?
You have 8 minutes.
112.
No, you could not. How many ounces do you think? You're the mayonnaise queen of Brookline.
How much mayonnaise could I eat?
Yeah, could you eat 128 ounces in 8 minutes?
A tablespoonful.
Okay,
that would be it. And
that's
have
what
to
you
do it
want
all.
To eat. The question is what you could choke down.
Okay, one more here, Corby, because I'm going to really tell to prove that people like Joey Chestnut, my man here, is really an athlete. Here's the all-time world record for deep-fried asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody not like deep-fried asparagus?
I do like deep-fried asparagus.
I love it.
Asparagus.
Here it is. How many pounds do you think he ate is this year, April 26, 2014, at the Stockton Asparagus Festival? How many pounds of deep-fried asparagus did he eat, and how many could you eat in 8 minutes, 10 minutes, pardon me? That would be Corby Cummer. How much could you eat in 10 minutes? How many pounds?
I feel I could go through 4 or 6 pounds.
Okay, and I think you feel incorrectly. How about you, Marjorie?
I think I would have a real problem being a competitive eater.
Okay, fine. Joey Chestnut ate 12 pounds, 8.75 ounces of deep-fried asparagus. So I admit it's revolting. It really is. By the way, I judged a pickle eating contest for
good
cause for some burn clinics out at Max's Deli in Stoughton, which is a great place, by the way, last year. But you got to have some athletic talent to be able to do this, do you not? Even if it is revolting.
Oh, of course. It's discipline, and I can imagine doing the training. And because I am able to eat many pounds of asparagus in a few minutes, as you adamantly refuse to believe, yeah. I now actually want to train for this.
You do?
Yeah, I didn't come in wanting to.
Well, can I tell you, when do you – you'll probably be back, what, in 2 or 3 weeks with us? Okay.
Yeah,
here's what we're going to do. We're either going to bring – you don't have to decide now. You have to email Chelsea after the show. We'll either bring 112 ounces of mayonnaise, which you said
no,
you could
no,
eat.
No, don't
okay.
do that.
Not mayonnaise. We will bring 12 pounds, 8.75 ounces. Of dried, pardon me, deep fried asparagus for your next visit, and we'll give you as much time. He had 10 minutes. We'll give you 10 minutes to eat as much as you possibly can. Is that a deal?
Okay.
Okay, fine. Okay, it's done. Do you have that on tape? We do have it on tape.
Yeah, but why? They're so exotic.
Don't film it,
didn't
please.
This all start with Nathan's and the hot dogs?
Yeah, it did.
A long
time ago.
You know, the hot dog eating, okay.
That was the first competitive eating.
That was the first thing. I don't know why I have to get into eating mayonnaise. I mean, that's really disgusting.
But by the way.
And chicken, because they got all the bones. They have to worry about the bones.
You don't have
too.
To
they're
eat the bones,
choke.
Marjorie.
I know that, but if you're trying to shove it all in really quickly,
it's actually
Jim,
better if you do, though.
What's that?
I mean, I think it tastes better if you do. I'm a big bone and gristle eater.
Really?
I never thought we were going to be discussing this.
How do you eat bones? They might choke.
You chew them. And you don't eat swallow
chicken
them
bones.
Carefully. You see, I've been training for this already.
Okay, fine. Let's move on to something that's actually much more edifying. I happen to like Boloco, not only because it's a local company, because I actually like the food. Shake Shack, maybe not so much, even though it's Michelle Obama's favorite fast food restaurant, as we well know. What do Boloco and Shake Shack have in common that is actually a very good thing, I think, for both? Well, what do they have in common, Corby Comer?
They pay higher than minimum wage starting out, and their average is much higher than minimum wage.
And what's the agenda? Why are they doing this, and what are the results?
Well, so they get a lot of good press out of it. The idea is that they spend less time training people because there's less turnover. In theory, once they are better to their employees, the employees are better to the customers, so they have a higher reputation. I say in theory because I'm supposed to be a skeptical journalist. I want to believe this. And I think John Pepper, who is the co-owner and local CEO of Boloco, has not been getting the credit he should during all of the minimum wage discussions about McDonald's and Walmart, which we're not talking about because it's not a fast food vendor. But he, from the beginning in 2002, paid well over minimum wage to his employees, and it has worked. It was a hit from his P&L sheet at the beginning, but he says that it resulted in less time training, better morale, and more customer retention.
Tell us about Boloco for those of us who have not been there.
Boloco are healthy burritos.
Okay.
So, doesn't it stand for Boston Local
Company or something?
Company or something. Yeah, I think it does. But go ahead.
And so they use fresh ingredients. They're one of the first off the mark. There are now a number like Sweet Green that we've talked about here that are sourcing local ingredients. It's fresh. You go up and decide what you're going to do, what you're going to have them make you and stuff your burrito with.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, it's all very custom. It's all very healthful. And they've got it down to a science where there's a whole bunch of healthful combinations on the menu on top. You can vary it, but it's just easier to stick with the ones they've come up with.
You know, not only are these practices the right thing to do so that people can almost have a life and almost afford to live a life. Listen to this. In the New York Times story on this, in 2002, when the minimum wage was $5.15, Boloco raised its minimum pay to $8. It also began subsidizing commuting costs, providing English classes to immigrant employees, and contributing up to 4% of an employee's pay towards a 401k. I always hope that these things are motivated by honor and decency, and you want good things to happen for those. I don't really care. If it turns out that, one, it, you know, improves your bottom line, which you argue it may in this case because of retention. But the third thing is they should publicize this like crazy. One of the reasons I'm Whole Foods obsessed, beyond the fact that I like the place a lot, is the guy has a reputation for treating his employees particularly well. I mean, that matters. And it seems to me, I don't think I'm an outlier, Corby Comer, that if I knew, Marjorie hasn't been to Boloco. Marjorie, you go to Honest Taqueria, don't you?
I've gone to Honest Taqueria,
okay, if
yeah.
you knew that Boloco, I don't know, have any idea how Honest Taqueria treats its employees, so let me apologize in advance. This is made up. If you knew that Honest Taqueria was only paying 80% as much to their workers as Boloco did and didn't give the same level of benefits, wouldn't you try Boloco if you knew that?
I think I'd try. I think the average person is going to say, well, where can I park? And
I don't agree with you. You think that works or no?
I want it to. You know, there's a number of ratings agencies. One is called How Good out of New York State that's getting traction even in Whole Foods that has a whole system of how they're rating the food product you buy. We just think in terms of, is it organic? Is it good for the environment? That's all great. I completely want to know about that. But what I'm even more concerned with is how do they treat their workers? And I think that's got to be primary on anybody's list of where they buy their food and where they eat out.
Does anybody rate? But you're talking about the how good, I assume, is, as you say, is a rating of the quality of the food and how they treat the animals, mm-hmm. whatever. Is there any rating of is there any one place to go that you know of which talks about how companies in a particular industry treat their people?
I say no now, but that means I'm immediately going to go out and research it because I know of a number of rating schemes for food that are trying to incorporate treatment of workers. How good is the most prominent and the one I've done the most work on, but there are several rivals. There are websites that are trying to look at this, but I think that worker treatment should be primary.
You know, there is something funny about the fact that we know how they treat their animals before we know how they treat their workers.
Absolutely
that
right.
That is a very fine point. But I would advertise it. And by the way, Marjorie, I hate to disagree with your own analysis of yourself. I know you a little bit, and I think that you would. You would more – you sort of said, well, I'd try it. I think you would try it. Obviously, you're not going to drive to Ohio if the company's only in Ohio.
I absolutely would because you feel – I mean, when you go into places – when you go into a fast food joint, which I haven't done in years because my kids aren't little and all that, but you do feel bad for these people that are working in these fast food restaurants.
Yeah, I don't want to think of the implications of how you had license to go into fast food places when your kids were
little. It's terrible. I did go for the Happy Meals. I must admit I did do it. Mostly it was because they had the playgrounds and the McDonald's, you know. You go sit there for a cup of coffee and your kids were little and they play for an hour and it was a break for mom.
That was my excuse. The only thing better than the food that you were feeding your kid when they were little at McDonald's, and I did the same thing, is when they would go into the disease-infected bowls. You know,
that
little thing where they jump into the bowls where you know that every disease known to man and woman is lying somewhere underneath those plastic bowls.
And they
bowls.
Have little tunnels that lead from one ball pit
Don't
to the next.
This.
And Jim
so one
time got stuck.
This is a true story.
We had to get the jaws of life.
Marjorie and I had a young kid. Marjorie had a young kid. One day, because we had to have a meeting, and we both had kid responsibilities, we went out to a Burger King on Route 1. I don't even know why we went where we went. And it turns out my kid got – this is true. My kid was, what, 2 or something then? Got scared by a spider in one of the – it was like the most complicated climbing thing ever. And so my kid was screaming and would not come out. So I said – so I climbed in. And I climbed – I'm rather large. I think you've noticed. And I barely fit. And the end of the story is the spider walked away. My kid climbed out, and I was stuck in the middle of the device.
Right. The Denham Fire Department.
All 6'5". Okay. No, the fire didn't come. It was one of the most humiliating experiences of my life.
I won't tell you about the woman I know who got stuck in an airplane bathroom for a cross-country flight.
That's
for extra transit.
Those are nice, too.
But the photograph on the minimum wage story had a huge banner on an In-N-Out Burger in California that said, "We pay X for minimum wage." What I want to know is why isn't Boloco saying we pay X
That's
minimum
a great
wage
question.
Right in its window and showing up, you know, McDonald's or Starbucks, I think, is very careful about not trumpeting a lot of its worker stuff because it wants to
have
this
feel good.
What are
you crazy, this college thing that they're pushing well beyond what the merits, I would argue,
of online education.
Yeah, which I think is really iffy. But putting that aside, it's all this guy's talking about. Didn't he go on The Daily Show and all this sort of stuff talking about this?
Right, but you don't see it in in-store signage.
That is correct.
And I think,
why don't
why
you
not?
Write a piece on this?
Be.
It's a great idea. There should be a website and there should be...
I feel sure there is a website. But yes, this is something that I'm always tracking. So, yep.
Fair enough.
Okay, can we move on to the, are we done with that? Please?
We are. We're talking to Corby Kummer, by the way, from The Atlantic, from Boston Magazine, all these kind of things.
So Mark Bittman, whose book I love because it teaches you how to cook everything, wrote a piece in the New York Times where he also works talking about how insulting and demeaning and terrible sounding the word foodie is. And we hear this all the time, people saying, "I'm a foodie." And he's right. It is demeaning and insulting. How should we deal with this, Corby Kummer?
Well, the week before I happened to have a book review in the Times that talked about the origin of the word foodie that provoked a lot of comment. And
you wrote it? You wrote a book?
He did.
Yeah,
we saw
it.
Him. Right. Yeah. I should have mentioned that to you. I was so thrilled. I opened up the Times book review, one of my favorite things, on Sunday, and there you were.
Why, thank you.
You reviewed 2 books.
I talked about foodie, and of course that's what inspired Mark. actually,
it, is that true?
It might well have. We'll have to call up Mark and ask him.
Fine.
But it certainly inspired a lot of people to write and correct me on the origin of the word foodie, which I said came about after the official Preppy Handbook and the Paul Levy, who with Ann Barr wrote the official Foodie Handbook the year after Preppy Handbook came out, said, we were working on it a year before we'd heard of the word preppy. It had nothing to do with it. But in any case, the problem is that foodie has acquired this sort of amateur, elitist, airy-fairy kind of dumb reflex, maybe I eat 12 pounds of a deep-fried asparagus connotation that none of us wants to have. So the problem with foodie, which I've loathed from the first time I heard it, is what else do you say that doesn't sound even more pretentious and pompous? I'm interested in food. I'm a gastronome. I'm a gastronaut. I write about food and you don't. You know, what can you say?
What can you say?
I don't know. I don't have a better word. But I'm interested in food is about as far as I go. I do not – I've never called myself a foodie.
Does anybody in your world not object to it? I would assume everybody finds it offensive. No, from chefs to restaurant owners to food writers to whomever. Is there anybody?
I think that anybody who makes a profession of it doesn't want to be demeaned and pigeonholed by it, and there's something that sounds trivializing and demeaning about it.
But there is there certainly is a spike in it because there, whether you call yourself a foodie or not, there are an awful lot of particularly young people now that are really into all this.
Right. And
where
what,
the food comes what, from, what are we eating, farm to table.
And what Mark is saying is let's incorporate all of the things that all of us right-minded food people was, by the way, what the term was, which is not so great because it sounds like a pod person, but food person is what it was. What we care about, which is worker safety, caring about the environment, the things that go into raising and making our food.
You know, I'm just trying to think. He doesn't like being called a foodie. I don't like being called a radio talk show host either. So what do we
you
do
don't?
About that? No.
Like
what should
that.
We be called? I am somebody
professional
who enjoys radio. Is that just – I am somebody
I don't know.
Who
I don't
does
know.
Radio.
But Bittman is right about foodie. What do you think of his cookbooks? How to Cook Everything.
Oh, this is – can I tell you what this is? I don't know Corby that well, but if you were here, you would say, uh-oh. I really don't like the cookbooks that much, but I really like Mark Bittman, so I'm not sure what I should say, so I will pause.
Well,
don't let him off the hook. Is that not – did I not perfectly capture what you were thinking?
You're a very perceptive guy.
Thank you.
I like basic cookbooks and think there's an absolute place for them, and I can point you to many.
Okay. Give me one more.
What kind of answer
Give me
is
one
that?
More.
Joy of Cooking.
I have Joy of
the
Cooking.
The 1974 edition.
No, you know what's wrong with Joy of Cooking? In all seriousness, it's a huge
Heavy
problem.
Cream.
No, the biggest problem with Joy of Cooking is recipes do not end on the same page that they begin. One of the great innovations,
please.
I don't know what year this, no, for an amateur cook like me, a foodie, an amateur, is recipes have to be on the same page, so you don't have to turn them in the middle of the cooking. Am I not right about that? Sure I am. Thank you. Okay,
now. All right.
But one last thing before we leave that, though. The Joy of Cooking thing is because it is dated, there is a lot of heavy food in there. And that's one of the things about Bittman's. He's more into spices. I mean, I'm a terrible cook, and I need instruction from beginning to end. But he does have a lot of spices, so you're not always loading everything up with butter and cream, which is my usual
I think
strategy.
Every generation discovers its own basic manual. So it was the Silver Palette Cookbook, which greatly influenced How to Cook Everything. So did Joy of Cooking.
Yep.
Somebody is able to summarize it and make it appeal to a generation, and Mark did that brilliantly.
Okay,
so Casablanca was a mainstay and then some in Harvard Square, I think for centuries. I have no idea. It was there a long time.
Since it happens, I'm sort of related by marriage to one of the guys who founded it when he was at Harvard. It was three founders of it as a club.
When?
And it was the early 1950s.
It was. So it is literally it's like 60 years worth.
Yeah,
it 1950s. Is gone. Alden and, is it Alden and Harlow is how you pronounce the thing?
Alden and Harlow, the names of the architect of the building on 40 Brattle Street where that the guys from Harvard originally bought.
So how is it? You were, have written a review in Boston.
So it's a really interesting restaurant. There's the cook, Michael Shelfo, who is kind of self-taught and kind of innovative. And what I talk about in the Boston Magazine review is this mismatch between lots of whimsical and really lovely line drawings of mushrooms and vegetables on cutting boards that make you think the whole thing is going to be kind of salad-y and build your own Boloco-style burrito. It's not. It's very ambitious, kind of macho, strapping chef's food.
Ooh.
So my favorite thing was, and you're all going to wince because it's rabbit. So it's picked rabbit
I like
meat,
rabbit.
Very aromatic and breaded with panko crumbs and deep fried and served with a blue cheese dressing like buffalo wings, which are better with the bones. Remember that. So this is completely picked meat. You know, it's heavy. It's really good. And he's great at grilled lamb. So it's all this kind of, you know, hearty but also chefy because it's beautifully plated food. And it made me think a lot about maybe it's time to retire farm to table, which always connotes somehow it's going to look like a bunch of vegetables heaped onto your
alfalfa
plate.
Alfalfa sprouts.
Right. This is very carefully made. I would argue there's something very masculine about it, even though a lot is vegetables. You know, really good and inventive food. And he rejects personally the label farm to table. And yet the whole restaurant ethos with those drawings, with the names of vegetables that name half of its dishes, you know, you think it's going to be this kind of good for you alfalfa style food.
How many times? I think I read in your review you ate there 3 times, correct?
Absolutely.
Do you have a rule of thumb about how many times you'll eat at a restaurant prior to your writing about
the
restaurant?
Of course, it's minimum 3.
Is that what people who do what you do for a living?
Yes.
That's the ethical kind of
right.
thing because
yep.
you may have a bad.
You, yeah. How do you handle the incognito part?
It's complete random accident.
Yeah.
I'm recognized because my picture's on the internet. It is thought by everybody that your picture's always on the internet and people can recognize you if they want to. What I find is a lot of the times I am, and then just randomly I am not. I'm, of course, always delighted when I'm not because there are huge service glitches. It's really fun. You know, sometimes I am. It doesn't make the food any better. It usually makes it worse.
Okay, before you go, I want you to raise your right hand, Corby, please, and repeat after me. Go ahead, raise your right hand. Raise your right hand.
Okay.
I, Corby Comer. Promise the next time I am here with Jim and Marjorie. I will attempt to eat. Let's
Very
not get
good.
Into that.
I will attempt to eat.
12 pounds, 8.75 ounces.
12 pounds, 8.75 ounces.
Of deep-fried asparagus.
Of asparagus.
Deep-fried asparagus.
He's not going for the deep-fried.
I don't care.
Like, asparagus.
Like Joey Chestnut did on April 26, 2014.
Just like Joey Chestnut did on April 26, 2014.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to it.
Okay,
we have to find a supplier.
Corby, we love you. We're on top of it. Don't worry.
Corby, thank you so much for being here. Corby Comer is a senior editor at The Atlantic, an award-winning food writer. Saw his great reviews, 2 of them. I'm right. It was 2 books, right? In the New York Times Sunday Book Review. That's great. Up
he
next.
Looks nervous, doesn't he, about the asparagus thing?
No,
look
you
at
have
him.
To
he's
do
like
it with me,
sweating
you know.
Already.
Yeah.
No,
I'm not doing it alone.
Goodbye,
I'll
Corby.
I'll eat a spear or two.
Goodbye.
Up next, are we on the brink of a media breakdown? Newspaper circulations are way down. Local TV is largely ignored by an important demographic, young people. And without the local gumshoe covering the boring beats, are our local politicians getting away with too much? Yes, they are. Karen Miller joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You remember the doping scandal that took down Alex Rodriguez? It got its start in the Caribbean with a dodgy medical college in Belize and with young athletes who see baseball as their ticket out of poverty.
It's a hugely life-changing sum of money that's on the table if they manage to stand out from the crowd.
The quest to end steroids in sports on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Yes, it's old news about the news. The newspaper is endangered with circulation forever plummeting. Though all politics is presumably local, political reporting apparently is not. And even though the internet is supposed to be the next frontier in journalism, our online venues like Vox and Vice, where we log on to get our news fix. Joining us, and we're going to get your involvement in this and a couple of you involved in this in a couple of minutes. Joining us first, though, to discuss where we are getting our news and who is giving it to us is Kara Miller. She, of course, is host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi. So, I mean, as you said, exactly right. So let's just lay it out in terms of newspaper and then local TV news, which people don't think as much about. But newspapers, this is just since 1990. 1890. So I'm not talking 1890 here.
Calm down, Marjorie.
Just since 1990, it used to be that 60 million papers were sold every single weekday. It's down to 45 million.
Wow.
So that's 25% decline since 1990, right? And we all know that things had declined before 1990. Then an interesting thing, local TV news, I wonder if it's headed down the same trajectory. So if you look at people who watch local TV news and you say, you know, okay, where do you regularly watch local TV news? And you ask people who are 65 and older, you're going to get most everybody saying yes. More than 60% of people 65 and older say, yeah, I regularly watch local TV news. You ask people under 30, what do they say? A quarter of them. A quarter of them, 25%, regularly watch local TV news. So if you own a local TV station, if you work at a local TV station, if you are an anchor, you've got to be looking at those numbers and thinking, wait a minute. Yeah, only the only people who watch us are old. And it's amazing. As you go down every 10 years, look at people in their 50s, 40s, 30s, fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer of those people watch local news. Where do they get their information? Online. I mean, when I wake up in the morning, how do I know what the temperature is outside? I've set my phone so that Google tells me what the temperature is. So, you know, you start to take away the incentive, I think, in a lot of ways, to watch local news.
Well, I'm surprised that it's even a quarter of people watching local news, because I don't know people that are middle-aged that watch the local news anymore. Maybe if you're like up at 75 or something like that. I mean, do you ever watch the local news?
Well, actually, I do the local news.
Wait a minute. Oh,
the two of you are talking like, do we know anybody who does this?
Okay,
no,
I know about you,
the...
but you used to be. Yikes. I mean, you know, it's a cliche around here to say, but there was a time when you knew it was Nat and Chet, and
yes.
it was a Liz Walker and who's the guy that did it at BZ? He was there until recently.
Jack
Williams.
No, actually, yeah. Jack Williams, I think, is still there.
It's still there. I could not tell you. I could not.
Obviously, you don't watch local news.
Who's doing the local? I have no idea.
Yeah, but can I? Let me just start with the first half of this, the print thing. My initial sense was that, and I'm obviously, I do an occasional thing, but Marjorie and a lot of other people we talk to, Brian McGorry of the Globe, this is their huge part of their lives. Originally, my sense was that downward spiral is just going to continue until it disappears. But then, lo and behold, what happened a few years ago is the people who run these newspapers got the message from the stats you say. And, you know, did you read the interview in Commonwealth Magazine with Mike Sheehan, the CEO of the Globe? I mean, they're going to be everything from a you know, this Catholic website to they may do television shows to there's huge amount of digital stuff. The Herald and the Globe have both won tons of awards for their video production.
So
is there diversification of the media through which they present the news going to keep them afloat?
What you're saying is that the newspaper business is so bad they're getting out of it. I mean, and that they're creating.
Or at least diversifying.
Right. They're diversifying. And I think that's because, you know, newspapers are headed towards being very niche publications. I mean, you see it with also, you know, weekly news magazines. When I was growing up, which was not that long ago, there were three big news magazines,
right.
U.S. News and World Report and Time Magazine and Newsweek. And there is one print publication left. And I get Time. And it's like the skinniest little thing.
It's horrible.
I mean, I think there is kind of one direction for newspapers. The question is, yes, can the New York Times, can the Boston Globe, can they reinvent themselves as purveyors of video, as purveyors of digital content? And that's tricky because, and I'm not saying they can't do it. They probably can, but it's tricky because they're built one way, right? They're built as an organization that produces a certain kind of product, and they've got to turn that ship around, and that's very, very hard work. And you actually saw when the whole Jill Abramson firing, you know, that was a whole kerfuffle. People talked about that digital report that Artur Sulzberger's son had put together about how the New York Times is dealing with digital. And in fact, what they were doing was making the people who did digital into second-class citizens. The people who got things on the front page of the paper, those were still the people who were lauded and who were treated well, even though many more people see the New York Times online than see the paper New York Times. I never see a paper New York Times. I look at the New York Times every day.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of the alternative things. I mean, there was a survey, and I'm sure you've seen this too, that showed maybe 6 months ago, a year ago, that the place where the vast majority of millennials are getting the news are from places like Colbert and The Daily Show and those sort of things. And as good, I'm not a huge Jon Stewart fan. I'm a huge Colbert fan. As great as one of them is, and a lot of people think the other one is, 99% of what they comment on, I know this is not an original thought, is from the newspaper in the morning. They're not generating original content. They're commenting quite brilliantly on content. We've been in talk radio for 15 years. A lot of our colleagues would always say, oh, let the newspapers close. Yeah, and then you listen to their show, and every single thing they're talking about during right. their four-hour show is from the Globe or the Herald that morning. So, I mean, there is this consciousness that even if they're alternative vehicles through which news would be delivered, that if the newspaper disappears, then the whole house implodes, right. doesn't it?
No, I think you are putting your finger on something really important, which is that you don't make very much money, nor can you really even get a job covering the city council or covering Discord in Afghanistan. And yet, those people are essential for you to function or for Stephen Colbert to make jokes or, you know, or to know what's going on, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So the question is that foundation that is kind of undesirable now that everybody builds their house on top of and makes money on top of, where is that going? And I actually talked to Clay Shirky, who has been a little bit of a fire thrower in the media landscape for a long time. And he said, basically, generally, covering the city council is a boring job. And it used to be that, you know, every newspaper had people covering city councils, even though it was mostly boring to write about and it was mostly boring to read about.
That's how you started, wasn't it? Wasn't that what you did as a cub reporter?
Actually, I began at the Septic Lagoon Commission.
That's true, right?
Didn't you? They call it the Septic Lagoon Commission?
In Westport, Massachusetts. Yeah, but that was a big beat. You went to these right. little tiny town meetings, the Conservation Commission right. of these tiny towns, the Zoning Board of Appeals. But the thing is, as boring as they may be,
yes.
all the corruption
That's
is
right.
going on there.
And in a way, having the reporter there is like, it's a way of basically saying, don't do anything bad, because if you do anything bad, I will write about it. And as you know, those people have disappeared. I mean, yeah. like, you talk to people like at the Herald or the Globe or whatever who covered City Hall back in the day, and they'll say, you know, we had balconies of people. Those balconies were full. Now they're like a couple yeah. people wandering around.
So in a second, we're going to ask Kara then what she thinks and the people she's interviewed think is the future of journalism, of news. But in the interim, you can join us at 877-301-8970. How do you get your news? Has it been evolving? Has it changed? If you're older, let's assume you're not a millennial, did you get your news one way when you were 20 and get it a different way now that you're 40 or 50? And if you are in that millennial group that Kara was talking about, only one quarter of whom pay any attention to local news, we'd love to hear from you, to hear if you're in the 75% or the 25% and why. The number is 877-301 8970. I mean, the issue is everybody gets the news, I guess, what is it called? On demand, essentially, now.
Right.
Is you get it when you want it, and you can get it instantaneously, right through your phone for the most part,
exactly.
right?
A lot of people get it on Twitter. Like, yeah. they follow yeah, the right. people that they're interested in, and those people link to things that they're interested in, or they follow CNN breaking news, and then they get the headlines that way. I think we're in this really interesting moment where a lot of the old structures have broken down, but what people don't know is what the new structures will look like. So, I don't know if you know Ezra Klein. He's done a lot of stuff on MSNBC, but he very recently left the Washington Post, where he was sort of a little bit of a golden boy, had his own blog, and he's gone over to this new thing called Vox, which is bankrolled, I think, to the tune of $40 million with venture capital. And it's basically sort of in-depth, here's a cool look at national news. We're going to interpret it for you. Very light on advertising.
Yeah.
And when you do click on something, you know, I watched this thing about why pot may be good for America with Ezra Klein. It's very high production value. He did this little video, and it's sponsored by GE. I didn't have to sit through a 30-second GE ad. It was just sponsored by GE. And what they're counting on is that they're going to attract the sort of smart young people who command a lot of ad dollars, and that GE will pay for the privilege of being associated with Vox, but not waste your time. And people like that.
And I think that, you know, it's obviously the future is going to be online. But the other question is, in your little towns that you live in, I mean, who is going to pay attention to the graft and corruption that's going on at the Zoning Board of Appeals? I mean, this impacts your property taxes, impacts your schools. Who's going to go to these school committee meetings that go on for like 9 hours where they're giving away all the jobs? I mean, someone has got to cover that, because if they don't, left to their own devices,
it will be, you know, Katie, bar the door.
Okay, let me say something about that. Is the only one of the three of us has actually been a public official for one ill-fated term as a Cambridge City Councilor. And that's not exactly a den of corruption, to say the least. I mean, it's a pretty
Not everybody's corrupt.
I will tell you, despite that and we're not some hick little community, there was always conversation about whether or not there was a reporter in the room when we were doing what we're doing. Even though it was broadcast live on CCTV, which is a wonderful operation, if there was a reporter, it was one thing. If there, I'm not saying we were going to do something illegal or unethical, but you did change your behavior. So those who think that there'll be accountability if there's no one there to force it are fooling themselves. 877-301-8970. Let's take a couple of calls for Kara Miller. Phil, you're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio with Kara Miller, Jim, and Marjorie. Hi there, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Okay. You know, me and my friends talk about the new media a lot. And one thing that seems pretty apparent is that the old institutions have just kind of lost their instinct for, like, their journalistic instinct to find the corruption and then the cojones to expose it. It just seems everybody falls short of the real story, and the new media, you know, all the muckrakers, they seem to hold, you know, that instinct, and they're going out there finding the story that it just seems, you know, like the big papers
don't cover anymore. Who are you talking about
that's
going out there doing all the muckraking on the, and the new media? Like who?
Well, you know, I mean, when you see a lot of stories, and then they always fall short of asking the questions that immediately come to mind. But then you go online and you find the journalists that have been fired, that have been demonized, they're still asking those questions.
Yeah, but Phil, I don't know what this deal is with the Providence Journal or whatever in your hometown, but let me just speak to Boston. Marjorie can defend the Herald because she knows it far better than I. As Brian McGrory tells us quite regularly, as he should, the editor of the Globe, there's a probation trial going on in the federal courthouse now. It's not going on because the U.S. attorney uncovered something. It's because the U.S. attorney read the Boston Globe series on this. All the crap we are reading about the shenanigans in the casino industry are a function of the newspapers. I have to say, maybe we're in a lucky place, but in this two-newspaper town where we're broadcasting from, the newspapers are surely doing the muckraking that you're talking about.
And the Boston Herald was responsible for bringing down the Department of Children and Families leader and exposing all that kind of stuff. I would say, with due respect,
Olga Rochet, we're talking about,
just the opposite.
I would too.
But the reason the newspapers aren't doing it as much as they used to is money. Because investigative reporting and spending the time to do corruption stories, you got to go to courthouses, you got to go through records. It takes hours and hours and hours, and they can't afford to do it anymore.
Well, and
you see
that the people who are doing that now are like the ProPublicas,
exactly.
Pierre Omidyar, who founded eBay, has given like $200 million. I mean, you think about
the
Boston Globe is where it is, or why the Washington Post. I mean, it is because, to be fair, billionaires opened up their wallets and said, this is an important mission, and we don't, you know, this is not going to sink us if we help.
Two billionaires, by the way, who have had no history in the newspaper industry.
Believed in what they were doing.
Yes.
Same with ProPublica. These are basically what we've got now is a whole generation of people, exactly as you said, who cannot figure out where the investigative journalism is coming from. And a few of those people are very, very rich, and they think it's important. And so they want to contribute to something that they believe to be a social good. And I don't know that they know how they're going to make money off it, if they're going to make money off of it.
Well, I think that's one of the most exciting things. John Henry at the Boston Globe and Jeff Bezos at the Washington Post,
right,
who are not newspaper guys, coming in and figuring out, because they've been very successful at making money, obviously, figuring out the new model. Because I'm sure there is. I just don't think we've gotten
there. Well, not only new model, but I would say I'm an outsider at the Globe, not an insider. But I would say as a consumer of the Globe, all the fears about John Henry ruling with a heavy hand in terms of the editorial decisions in this, I sure as hell am not seeing it. Maybe there's something I'm missing. But you're right. He worries about the business model and lets the McGrorys and whatever others, at least it seems to me, do their work. 877-301-8970. We're talking to Kara Miller about where you get your news and what the future of the news industry is. Tom, you're in Sharon. You're on with Kara Miller, Jim, and Marjorie. Hi there, Tom.
Oh, hi there. Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I'm calling. I am a refugee from the newspaper industry. I got out around 2000 when there was like wave after wave of layoffs and buyouts. And I don't even get the daily newspaper anymore just because they're so light that, you know, there's very little to read in them anymore. But I think, you know, the model for the future, I really think it's got to be like the BBC. If not a government entity, a public-private consortium. Reporting is news is a labor-intensive thing, and no one seems to be willing to spend the money to actually get it done.
Well, except the one. I think the exceptions were just stated by Kara Miller. People with no news backgrounds who have decided either for selfless reasons or because they think there's money to be made. Washington Post and the Globe, two perfect examples.
And we have the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Yeah. Right in the building.
And there's sort of a few different ways of supporting some serious news. One is you get some really rich people to bankroll you. One is something like the BBC, you get the government to bankroll you. One is something like NPR, you get individual people to say, hey, is this important? Will you bankroll us? And the other one is you get advertisers. And the thing that happened to newspapers, which made them break apart, was Craigslist and Monster.com and all the things that used to be the car ads and the classifieds and all the things that used to be in the newspaper and that people needed the newspaper for started to go away. And I think it's really one of those four things. And it's funny, when I talked to Clay Shirky, who, like I said, has been a bit of a disruptor in the media industry, he said he thinks the best future is the NPR-like future, where it is people saying, do you like what we're doing? I mean, I don't know if you know Kickstarter, but this is very much the model of Kickstarter. Like, I have a product. Do you like it? If you do, I'd really appreciate it if you could give me some cash, because then I can build the product and send one to you. And that's, you know, and that's it.
But isn't
money that way? Yeah.
Isn't the newspaper the predecessor of Kickstarter? If you like what I do, you buy the newspaper.
No, if you
why not?
Newspapers, how did they make their money? From Macy's, from Ford Motor
Company? Oh, you're saying because without the display ads, they couldn't have done it.
The classifieds and stuff. So this is a way of saying we're not going to advertise, really. We're going to make a product. Are you interested? Do you want to support it?
Then give us
some money.
No, I love it. And obviously I love it because it's working in this particular instance.
I mean,
yeah,
it's one of the few
Boston
things.
Public
it's a
Radio.
Funny thing because it's an old model, but it's one of the few things that hasn't broken apart yet. And there are like foundations that help with NPR. I mean, you see like the Ford Foundation does contribute. So it's sort of a hybrid, but in some ways, it is a bit of a precursor to the Kickstarter thing. And I think young people, who are most of the people who support people on Kickstarter, are much more likely to say, we like this person or this show or this product. We want to support this specifically.
I just want to say, before people send emails, we'll save you time. A very small percentage of our money comes from the government. So don't waste your time on the email.
That's true,
actually. What are you doing tonight and on Saturday?
So tonight we're talking about whether America is still going to be the place for innovation in the 21st century. And we're talking about Julia Child. And on Saturday, we're talking about the future of the news media and the future of higher ed. Clay Shirky is throwing bombs all over the place.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, the important thing is, she says, NPR is doing very well, and that's where we are. So that's a good point. Kara Miller is the host of Innovation Hub. Tonight at 9 o'clock and Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock, you can catch Kara Miller. And coming up, we get another perspective on Boston College Oral History Project. Very controversial. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
The troubles that are never over.
The American government invested untold political capital, and this thing that the police are trying to do over there, it makes no sense to me.
The Northern Ireland troubles come alive in an oral history project that could put U.S.-UK relations on a collision course. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and the Summer Investigative Reporting Workshop for high school students at Boston University, where students learn critical thinking and research skills, how to do in-depth reporting, interviewing, and more. NECIR.org/summer. And It's Your Move, Inc. Founded in 2002, It's Your Move manages residential moves for seniors, from decluttering your current home to setting up your new home. More info at itsyourmoveinc.com.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Regan. For 5 years, as part of an ambitious oral history project, Boston College collected more than 40 interviews with former militants who were part of the sectarian violence that ravaged Northern Ireland. These interviews were done with assurances from those who did them that everything would remain confidential. But in 2011, federal government subpoenaed BC, telling them to hand over some of these interviews to British authorities who were investigating the murder of Jean McConville. Ultimately, BC decided to return everything to the people who participated in the project. This, however, has not put an end to anything. Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen, who was with us yesterday, went to Belfast to follow up on the repercussions of the Oral History Project run amok. Many of the participants feel their lives are threatened. Today, joining us for a different angle in the same story is Jack Dunn. Jack is the Director of News and Public Affairs at Boston College. Jack, it's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
We'd like to point out how wonderful it is that Jack would come in from his vacation on Cape Cod to come up and talk to us about this. You know, Jack Dunn, the Belfast Project was a great idea. It seemed like a great idea to get these histories. But then, of course, you were subpoenaed by the Department of Justice, Boston College was, to turn the information over, although the people that ran the project gave these confidentiality assurances to the people that they interviewed. Why did you do it? Reporters all the time get subpoenaed by the government to turn in sources. They don't do it. Why did Boston College do it?
Because academic institutions don't have the same protections that journalists have. And this case has underscored that. I think it's astounding that the narrative has been established that Boston College somehow was forced to comply with the subpoena. We're an academic institution. Number one, we don't burn academic records, as Anthony McIntyre suggested. We don't burn research. We don't destroy materials.
Anthony McIntyre, one of the leaders of the project. Yes. And by the way, he and his wife, we'll hear from them in a minute, called in from Northern Ireland a couple of months ago when we were discussing this. But go ahead, Jack. I'm sorry.
We were faced with two federal subpoenas. We fought a vigorous defense over 2 years, and we won a significant court victory that protected some 75 to 80 interviews from being sent overseas. So Boston College did what it could legally. The criticism from Anthony McIntyre and Project Director Ed Maloney is that we didn't do enough. But I think it's a cultural divide, Marjorie. I think they don't understand, particularly Anthony McIntyre, who spent most of his life incarcerated in Northern Ireland. They don't have a respect for the legal system. We do. We engage the legal system. The legal system rendered a verdict. We had to accept that verdict. But we won a significant court victory. So the narrative that we didn't do enough is specious.
But one thing on that, there is no reporter shield law in Massachusetts. Some states have them. Lots of states don't. There's no federal shield law either. So many reporters, I mean, some of my colleagues, when faced with a subpoena from the government, have said, well, I'm not going to give up my source. I'm going to go to jail.
James Risen from the New York Times is with us a couple of months ago in the same situation.
And almost inevitably, the government backs down. You chose not to back down at Boston College.
We chose to fight the court. We fight through the courts. We attempted to quash both sets of subpoenas, and we fought a vigorous 2-year defense that won a significant court victory. In fact, the Department of Justice was furious that Judge William Young of the federal court here in Boston even heard this case. They said that given the MLAT treaty, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty between the United States and Great Britain, a college had no right to infringe upon that treaty, claiming that it had some degree of academic freedom that it was trying to preserve. So we won a victory for academic research. It wasn't a full victory, but it was a significant victory for the enterprise of academic research.
You know, Marjorie and I, as I'm sure you know, Jack Dunn, are experts on treaty law. I'm sure you've... yesterday, when Kevin Cullen was here, he brought something to our attention that, frankly, I wasn't aware of. Obviously, I'm kidding. And you may be. I'm sure you are. He said that this treaty that you're describing has political exemptions, that if there are political prosecutions, and he says the potential prosecution of Gerry Adams, who obviously was arrested and interviewed for a handful of days, arrested by Northern Ireland standards, not formally charged with a crime, interviewed for days, that there are that clearly in his mind would have been a political prosecution, and you could have claimed the exemption, which would have caused you to have been able to resist this subpoena. One, did you? And if you didn't, why didn't you?
That's Kevin's contention. I have great respect for Kevin. I think in terms of American journalists, he's the most versed on Irish affairs. The MLAT treaty, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty that exists between the United States and Great Britain, is on criminal activity. And the treaty was invoked because of the horrific abduction and murder of Jean McConville, a Belfast mother of 10 who was...
Widowed mother of 10, yeah.
Who was taken right in front of her kids from her home in Belfast, brought across the border, shot in the back of the head and buried in a beach. So It was the MLAT Treaty on Criminal Activity, this particular horrific crime that was invoked. So while Kevin claims, and I'm sure he's right, that there's a political exemption, there was no exemption for the criminal activity of the murder of Jean McConville.
Let's just get back to the line of questioning that Marjorie was involved in a minute ago. Taking everything you said in response is legit. Were there internal discussions about noncompliance, that you fought as hard as you could? As right. you say, you believe you protected as much as one possibly could, whatever you said, 75%. Were there discussions with the president and others saying, hey, listen, even though we've done as much as we can legally, we have to protect academic research. This could do great damage, not just to us, but to the whole notion of oral histories and that sort of thing. Other people in the future might be more resistant, maybe after Iraq or Afghanistan or something else, be more resistant to participating in something like this. Were there those discussions?
There were. We considered every opportunity, every option, and we determined that this was our best course of action. Simultaneously, we worked with the State Department to try to secure some relief from the State Department, from the United States government, because the United States government had invested so much in this peace process. But ultimately, given the climate post 9/11, there seemed to be no desire in Washington to appear to be coddling terrorist activity. And the IRA and the also volunteer force are terrorist organizations. So there was no sense in Washington that people wanted to help. The courts did what they could. We did the best possible. We did as well as we could on behalf of oral history by fighting through the courts, and that was the best outcome we thought we could achieve.
You know, one of the things we discussed with Kevin is obviously going home. You read the piece and you've discussed the piece when he went to Belfast about the fear that some people live through. I mentioned that when Tommy O'Neill, is he currently on the board of BC or what?
He's a trustee associate.
Trustee associate right. at BC. When correct. We were talking to Tommy O'Neill about this, after we hung up with him a couple of months ago, actually Anthony McIntyre, as I said, and his wife, Carrie Toomey, called in. Here's what Toomey said, the wife, in response to the question of whether or not they feel that their lives have been put in danger by the disclosure of the information. Here's Carrie Toomey.
When graffiti, such as in former Republicans' Boston College touts, goes on the walls of the Falls Road, which has happened this morning, yes, we are at risk. And it's not just us, my family, my husband and my children that are at risk. It is all the people that participated okay. very bravely in this project.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know what the word tout was till Kevin explained it to us. He says, snitch is what yeah. we talk about. When you hear that, even, again, if you think you did everything you can, what do you and your colleagues at BC feel when there are people who legitimately feel their lives are at risk because of this?
The reality of this case is that the project director, Ed Maloney, signed a contract with the Burns Librarian at Boston College to conduct this archive project, in which the contract stated specifically that confidentiality would be limited to the extent that American law would allow. As part of the court records, one can easily find the facts that Bob O'Neill sent to Ed Maloney saying, I cannot guarantee, for example, that this would withstand a federal subpoena if one were to be issued. The reality that Mr. McIntyre and Mr. Maloney don't share is that no one thought it would come to this. Given the investment of the Irish government, the British government, and the American government in forging the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, no one thought that the police service of Northern Ireland would ever take this step.
Yeah, but the guy from your own library is quoted in one of the earlier stories by Peter Schwarm saying it wasn't even run by the lawyers at the BC. You have some regret about that.
Sure, there were mistakes that were made, but the biggest mistake from our perspective was that Anthony McIntyre gave assurances of confidentiality to the interviewees that he was in no position to make. That is an issue that hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. It's important.
Let's see. We should hear, by the way, McIntyre, I think, disagrees with you. Here is McIntyre sure. when he called us about the issue of whether or not he was promised complete secrecy. Here's Anthony McIntyre.
Very clear that there were no circumstances under which this material could be handed over without the approval of the interviewee. There is no room for ambiguity on this.
Is he wrong?
He's absolutely wrong. And it's important to note that it was Anthony McIntyre who spoke with the IRA interviewees. No one from Boston College ever spoke with any of the interviewees. I don't even know who they are.
But they work for you.
McIntyre was hired by project director Ed Maloney to conduct interviews.
And yeah, but it's a BC project, Jack. I mean, it isn't
true.
Like there's
I agree. Okay. And I'm not trying to – people at Boston College who were involved made their share of mistakes. But it was clearly the mistake of the project director and Anthony McIntyre, who gave assurances of confidentiality that they were in no position to give.
You know, Jack Dunn from Boston College, you're the spokesman for Boston College. I guess we could call you somewhat in the PR business. So you think about optics and how things look. Suppose it had been different. Suppose Father Leahy is still the president of Boston College. Suppose Father Leahy had gotten on the steps up there in Chestnut Hill and said, we have a very fragile peace process in Northern Ireland. If we release this information, people's lives will be at stake. The process that we spent decades trying to achieve, it could totally fall apart. I am standing here on behalf of Boston College. I will go to jail rather than turn these over. The president of Boston College, with the power, the political power of the Irish in Massachusetts, the Irish in Boston, the Democrat, what do you think would have happened? I know what I know what would have happened. The Department of Justice would have backed down, just like the government backs down in almost every situation I can think of when a reporter has said, I will go to jail because the government looks like a big bully. And I guess maybe not Leahy. Maybe you could have gone to jail. But you know what I mean? What would have happened if BC had dug in its heels and made that statement and said, we are protecting the citizens of the peace process and the citizens who gave their confidential information whose lives are at stake?
Again, we saw it through diplomatic channels to achieve that end.
Yeah.
I don't think it needed to be as public and dramatic as you stated. We saw it through diplomatic channels to achieve that end, but there is no appetite in Washington right now to appear to be coddling terrorist activity of any form. And that's the reality of Washington post 9/11.
Was one of the diplomatic channels John Kerry?
I don't think it's fair for me to say specifically who it involved, but I think it's easy. John Kerry has a connection to Boston College, and so he was one of many people that the college reached out to seek their assistance.
And you think when we talk about terrorism in 2014, I don't think we're talking about the IRA in the 1970s in Ireland. You think they're all lumped together?
I do. That was our sense in seeking assistance from Washington, that there was no appetite to protect any form of terrorism.
And okay. Jack, last thing from me, then you can return to vacation. here's a piece from Kevin's column on Sunday, I guess it was, reporting on the prior Sunday. Boston College, meanwhile, did more than any American university to engage both the political and civil society on both sides of the Irish border. I think there's a consensus well beyond Kevin. There's no American university.
Agreed.
It's been more important in the history of the Troubles and beyond. BC has hosted, this is Kevin still, BC has hosted hundreds of politicians, journalists, civil servants, and peacemakers from Northern Ireland over the years. But in all this bitter recrimination, the Boston brand has suffered in Ireland. So again, even if you think, as you said, we made some mistakes, everybody did, we did the best we could under the circumstances, how do you, the president, how do people react to that? I mean, that's real, is that there is he has the great line from Anthony McIntyre, the horrible line from Anthony McIntyre at the end of his piece saying, I can't even listen to More Than a Feeling by Boston, the band, because I don't want anything with Boston. I mean, there is some a negative impact in a place I know you all care a lot about BC.
The history of Boston College has been inextricably linked with Ireland and Northern Ireland. We were heavily involved in securing the Good Friday Agreement. In fact, our conflict negotiators, one of our Jesuit priests, was involved in bringing the sides to the table. Our political scientists worked closely to help form the new government by telling people how to share power. So we have been heavily involved in that, and I think our reputation is solid. People understand that we hired individuals who weren't the best fit for us to conduct a project to reside in our library, to provide a resource for historians. Mistakes were made, things that happened that people didn't think would happen. So if the BC brand has suffered, then we'll redouble our efforts to improve that brand and to do the work that we've always done moving forward that puts BC in the spotlight as being America's leading university in Ireland. But I think the blame for this should go to all those who are involved in the attempt by Mr. Maloney and Mr. McIntyre to deflect blame from themselves and put it on the hands of Boston College doesn't hold up to the light of scrutiny.
Jack Dunn,
thank you for coming. I'm sure this has been a fun couple of days talking about
this. Good to
speak
to you, Jack.
Especially during your vacation. I appreciate you very much coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Dunn is the Director of News and Public Affairs at Boston College. So it kind of makes you miss Ted Kennedy, doesn't it, Jim?
Boy, does it ever.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We're going to have a smackdown between the presidents of Mount Auburn Cemetery and the Arnold Arboretum and, of course, Emily Rooney's world-famous list. This show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team is Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan. Our engineer is John Parker, and our intern is Devin Karambalis. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Please listen again tomorrow.